Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. So my name is Matthias Koenig-Akibuji. I'm an associate professor of global politics here at LSE, and I'm very happy, very pleased to be the chair for today's event. So it's my pleasure to introduce today's speakers, Thomas Hale and David Held. Thomas Hale is associate professor of public policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. His research is on extremely important topics. It's about how to make the world a better place to solve global problems and address transnational issues. And he is the author of some very interesting books, Between Interest and Law, The Politics of Transnational Commercial Disputes, and Transnational Climate Change Governance. So I'm a big fan of Tom's research, because it seems to me that it combines two things that are not always present in modern political science, which is attention to the very big problems facing humanity, not afraid to ask difficult big questions, but at the same time, the most rigorous analytical and methodological standards. Okay, so this is a combination that I love about Tom's work. So I'm very glad that he's here tonight to present his work. I should say that he has an AB and a PhD from Princeton University, and also a master's degree from LSE. So I'm proud to say that. Welcome back, Tom. The second speaker for today is Professor David Held. He's Professor of Politics and International Relations at Durham University and also Master of University College there. So he was formerly at LSE as well, so welcome back to David. I cannot start even listing his books. There are too many. It would take me a long, long time, but I need to mention one book, which is Democracy and the Global Order, simply because it had a huge impact on the way that people think and study global politics today. So this was a really path-breaking book, and it is difficult to exaggerate this path-breaking. It inaugurated a whole new research stream on the relationship with globalization and democracy. So this is, in a sense, the origin of a whole literature. So David and Tom and Kevin Young, who is not here today, in 2003 published a book called Gridlock. Okay, so this came from some of the most forceful, strong advocates of multilateralism, but it was a rather depressing book, and even somehow distressing, you know, because you have some professional pessimists out there who always are, you know, negative about international cooperation, but Tom and David were not, definitely not, so they are not the usual suspects, but they were a little bit, you know, worried about the direction that multilateral cooperation was taken, you know, with very, very powerful arguments. But they also gave us a glimmer of hope at the end, so I'm very, very pleased to report that they have expanded and elaborated on this glimmer of hope in the newest book that they are going to present today, which has some co-authors. Two of those are here, Professor Michael Clark and Professor Tom Pigram, who are going to be introduced later. So a couple of just practical issues. So you have seen the book is being sold outside. You are also very welcome to join us for a reception that will take place after the lecture on the 8th floor of this building. So take the lift up to the 8th floor, and I hope to see you there. And also that the authors will be happy to take questions at the end of their presentations, okay? So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to David Held.
Well, good evening to you all. It is a great pleasure for me to be here at the LSE, no doubt the best social science university in the world. I had many happy years here, and it's great to be back. I have three thank yous I want to make before saying anything substantive. First of all, in the audience is the former director of the LSE, Anthony Giddens, who has made a huge impact at the LSE. He made a huge impact at the LSE, and he made a huge impact on my life as a mentor and inspiration. So I just want to say how pleased I am that he's here this evening. I want to thank Matthias for organizing this event this evening. It may seem easy to you to think to organize an event, but it's another 50 emails at least, if not more. And every event is more demanding. And finally, I want to say something about Tom. I first met Tom at the LSE when he came to study in my master's there in global politics. Very talented student he was. But over the course of the year, I think it's only fair to say we talked more and exchanged more. And although he then went off to Princeton to do a PhD, he did come back to London. And since then, these conversations have continued. And it's a great pleasure for me now over many years to have worked with Tom on gridlock and beyond gridlock. And there's another one in the making, but that won't be for another 2 or 3 years. So it'll be the third and probably last in this sequence. It's worth saying something briefly about why we wrote these books, because it says something about the issues they address. First of all, gridlock. Gridlock was written against the backdrop of the breakdown of the Doha trade negotiations, the calamity at Copenhagen, and the collapse of a certain trajectory of climate negotiations. And in one sector after another of multilateral negotiations and discussions, there seemed to be gridlock. I went to many lectures, as did Tom, on why Copenhagen failed, why this failed, and everyone was trying to produce an explanation about why multilateralism was collapsing in particular sectors and treated it as sui generis. But it seemed to us that the interesting questions were transsectoral. There was something going on underneath that was deeper. And that's the issue we tried to address in gridlock. And Tom will say much more about the second book, Beyond Gridlock, later. But Beyond Gridlock emerged from Tom and I giving lectures about gridlock probably around the world and depressing a whole generation of students. And I remember the denouement for me came in Hamburg when I was talking at the Design Foundation, and there were 50 very talented young people in the room, and at the beginning they were all buoyant, at the end they were absolutely depressed, and there were almost no questions. And then I remember saying to Tom, you know, gridlock captures something, but it doesn't quite capture all we need to say. And slowly, as Tom will explain later, we began to reflect on what it didn't capture and why. But what I want to do today is say something about the first book and set up the questions for Beyond Gridlock. And then Tom will say something about the Beyond Gridlock in more detail. And I want to start by saying something about, very briefly, about the kind of the crossroads we are at global politics. And it seems very much we are at a kind of global crossroads. If you reflect on the 1930s, we saw the rise of xenophobia and nationalism in the context of a prolonged and protracted economic strife, the lingering impact of World War I, weak international institutions, and a desperate search for scapegoats. And in the 2010s, what do we see? We see some parallels. We see the protracted fallout of the global financial crisis and years now of austerity policies. We see ineffective and weak international and regional institutions. We see a growing xenophobic discourse that places virtually all blame on some form of other. In the 1930s, of course, we know where it led. In the 2010s, the jury is still out, but there are some notable parallels. And the question is, why has there been a retreat to nationalism and militant identity politics? From Trump's America to Brexit Britain, from Orban's Hungary to Modi's India, from Erdogan's Turkey to Duterte's Philippines, and much in between recent elections in Germany, which have seen the far right reestablished in the mainstream of German politics. What is going on? In order to try and think about what is going on and think about some of the deep structures, we need to have ways of describing them. And Tom and I in Gridlock, the first book, came across this, focused our discussions on this very concept as a way of trying to understand why it is that the post-war settlement, which was so important in engendering 70 years of prosperity and the development across the world, seems to be coming to an end. That era seems to be coming to an end. And Gridlock tries to explain why. So in order to understand why, this is just a brief visual reflection on the foundations of the United Nations, of course. And of course, as you know, as any students of politics will know, this comes against the backdrop of catastrophe in the first half of the 20th century, not just two great wars, but the Great Depression. And all these politicians gathered at the foundation of the UN had one mission in mind, not just to prevent a third world war, but to create the conditions for trade and prosperity that might bind nations together in a common purpose in the future. And the UN was designed to govern, to underpin this common purpose through the rule of law and so on. So the post-war institutions then were consciously designed to create a kind of peaceful and prosperous world order. And they did establish, and I'm going to very briefly say why, the conditions under which a multitude of actors and people could go benefit from forming and investing in stable political institutions, companies, corporations, investing abroad, creating global production chains, and engaging in all those activities that we today think of as globalization. And what this diagram shows is that the post-war settlement creates the institutional structures for allowing the impetus and logic of capitalism to develop, and the impetus and logic of technological change, creating the conditions for interdependence to emerge across the world. That needs to be managed by institutions, and you get the beginnings of a virtuous circle, which we think underpins the post-war order and 70 years of post-war prosperity. This is not to say that the post-war institutions were the only cause of the dynamic form of globalization that we've seen in the last several decades. But it is to say that all the changes that took place since 1945 could develop and thrive because they took place in a relatively open, relatively peaceful, relatively liberal, relatively institutionalized world order. It was an effective design, and it worked for many decades. But the nub of it is that, and this is what we suggest in the first book in Gridlock, is that these developments have now progressed to the point where our ability to engage in further global cooperation is in question. That is, the economic and political shifts, in large part attributable to the success of the post-war era, are now amongst the factors grinding it into gridlock. In areas such as nuclear proliferation, the explosion of small arms sales, over as many guns as there in America as there are now people in just one country alone, failed states, terrorism, global poverty and inequality, biodiversity losses, water deficits, climate change, in all these areas, multilateral governance and transnational governance seems increasingly ineffective and threadbare. Why is the question we asked in Gridlock. And we said there were four causal pathways to Gridlock. Each one in itself could be a sufficient explanation in a given sector and area of global governance, but together they're pretty calamitous. Why is that? Well, very briefly on each, emerging multipolarity. In a sense, you know, emerging multipolarity is the great achievement of the post-war era. We've shifted from a unipolar, bipolar world order to the conditions under which a multitude of states and nation states could thrive and develop. And the shift in the economic center of gravity that was mid-Atlantic in the previous century is now moving eastwards and by 2050 may well lie between India and China is the unintended consequence of the success of this post-war period. On the one hand, reaching agreements in international negotiations is difficult. But it's made more complicated by the rise of new powers like India, China, and Brazil, because a greater diversity of interests have to be hammered into any agreement. On the one hand, multipolarity is a positive sign of development. It's good, it's great. On the other hand, it means that more voices and more interests have to be hammered into an agreement for any kind of stable post set of negotiations and results to emerge. And that's difficult. So if five of you want to go to the cinema afterwards, it's easy to have a discussion and decide what film you're going to go to. But if you ask 100 people to come to a view, it's much more likely that many of you will go to different films, and you may watch, you may or may not meet up afterwards. But multipolarity, which means more interests and more voices articulated on the global stage, collides with the second issue. I'm going to do them slightly out of order, which is harder and more complex problems. Growing interdependence creates transborder, transnational problems which can't be solved by individual states acting alone. The problems we face increasingly on the global scales are more complex, penetrating deeply into domestic policies, and are often extremely difficult to resolve. Obviously, the paradigm case, climate change, but there are many more examples. And when multipolarity collides with complexity, then getting negotiations at the global level becomes even harder. And this is against the backdrop of two other trends. One, and that's institutional inertia, that the core multilateral institutions that we've inherited today were all founded by and large in post-war era, and they have at their core the post-war global power structure frozen into their institutional operations. And that is very hard to change. So there's deep inertia in the international organizational structure. At the same time, because there is inertia, there's been a huge fragmentation of transnational organizations of all kind that seek to compensate for the bureaucratic inertia of the larger organizations, but they often compete with each other, jurisdictions often overlap, and they often don't solve the problems they are geared to solve. So after the last great tsunami, there was aid shifted from all over the world. States and non-state actors rushed to get aids into the relevant areas, and Oxfam now estimates that 85% of that aid missed its target. It wasn't for lack of engagement, it wasn't for lack of people on the ground, it was for lack of coordination, agenda setting, and cohesion in operations. So today, all this is to say that these trends combine in many ways to make successful cooperation at the global level extremely difficult to achieve. And all these, in some senses, are the unintended consequences of the post-war order. The US, by and large, designed the post-war order. The Bretton Woods institutions were designed by the United States with some consultation with European allies. But their unintended consequences has been growing multipolarity, outstripping the usefulness of the existing institutions. Interdependence creates much harder and more complex problems to resolve against a backdrop of institutional inertia and fragmentation. That's why there is drift at the global order. And these trends combine to make cooperation at the global level today increasingly difficult. And the risks that follow are all too obvious. To manage the global economy, to prevent runaway environmental destruction, to rein in nuclear proliferation, or to confront other global challenges, we have to cooperate. But many of our tools for global policy making are breaking down or inadequate for these very reasons at a time when we need them the most. Signs of this today are everywhere. We still have climate change threatening all life as we know it, conflicts in the Middle East still running out of control, small arms sales proliferating despite efforts to contain them, migration increased enormously and destabilizing many societies, and inequality threatening the fabric of many countries today. So today we have gridlock, but the bad news is gridlock, the virtuous circle of interdependence that generated the post-war order, has now got a negative dimension to it, self-reinforcing gridlock. I want to just explain that and then hand over to Tom. Why has gridlock got a self-reinforcing element? And why does that help us explain why we're at a crossroads in global politics? I just want to say something very briefly about that. There are four stages to what Tom and I see as self-reinforcing gridlock. The first I've already described, the top. a multilateral system that is less and less able to manage the very global challenges it faces, even as interdependence increases and places more demands upon us. Second, in many areas, this has led to symptoms of unmanaged globalization. Serious harm to major sectors of the global population, often creating complex and disruptive effects. Perhaps the most obvious and spectacular example was the 2008-09, of course, global financial crisis, which wrought havoc on the world economy in general and on many countries in particular. Third, the backlash. These developments have been a major impetus to significant political destabilization. Economic inequality, an ever-present trend, has been made all the worse by the global financial crisis, reinforcing a stark political cleavage between those who have benefited from globalization, digitization, and the automation of the economy, and those who felt left behind, including many working-class voters in industrialized countries. And this division is particularly acute, of course, in spatial terms. Global cities like London, even Edinburgh, London and Edinburgh, if you look at their voting profiles and so on, have more in common often than they do with their respective hinterlands. So London, Paris, Shanghai, New York, San Francisco have become nodes of power and influence in the global economy, the real winners of globalization, as it were. Their citizens have broadly benefited directly from the opportunities that have sharply increased. By contrast, those in the hinterlands, typically in rural areas and deindustrialized cities, have often been left behind in absolute and relative terms, building up frustrations, resentments, in effect, creating a politics that swings towards nationalism, populist movements, rising authoritarianism, and so on. Briefly, before I finish, the financial crisis is just one of many, many other examples that we could point to. But another I want to just briefly mention is, of course, the post 9/11 wars, the negative fallout from them, and their particular impact on migration. There's a great paradox here that many of the politicians who were most internationalist and European in the last decade in Britain have unleashed wars, the unintended consequence of which has been the emergence of huge migratory forces that have breached those countries, that have led partly to political destabilization and reaction. With millions of refugees fleeing their homelands, many recipient countries, naturally enough, have experienced a potent political backlash from right-wing national groups and disgruntled populations, which further reduces the ability of countries to generate effective solutions to common regional problems. And hence, you move from this virtuous circle, wherever I can find it, wrong way, of the post-war era, to the risk of this very negative cycle depicted here. And we see these trends across many different countries. But the anti-global backlash is heterogeneous and full of contradictions. To name some, you have leftist rejections of trade agreements, right-wing rejections of environmental agreements, producing a very complex mélange of politics. But what they all have in common are political parties and mobilizations which want to reject a world of global interdependence and global cooperation and reassert national priorities and interests. The result is the further erosion of global cooperation, producing this negative, destructive cycle. In sum, you haven't been listening, just listen for 30 seconds. Post-war democracies were supported by a virtuous set of institutions, international institutions founded after the Second World War that provided momentum for sustained periods of economic growth, geopolitical stability, that led, of course, to the transformation of the world economy in 70 years, the shift from the Cold War to a multipolar world order, and the rise of communication network societies. Extraordinary transformations. But the argument of gridlock is what works now, what works then does not work now, as gridlock freezes problem-solving capacity, and therefore we face much more dangerous global political drift. from the financial crisis to new waves of migration and so on. Gridlock, alongside, I should add, the fallout from the catastrophic 9/11 wars, has helped engender a crisis of democratic politics, a crisis of political compromise and negotiation, and has given way to populism and authoritarianism in many countries. While this remains a trend and not yet set in stone, it is a powerful and dangerous set of developments. And if we left it there, you would be as depressed as everyone has been listening to the versions of this lecture. So the real question then is, how do you change this world? How do you begin to make a difference to these dynamics? Well, the superficial answer is that you can do it through bottom-up social movements and civil society, through horizontal pressures of international institutions, and top-down pressures from enlightened leadership and states. But as soon as you've said that, you have said very little. And that's when the social science begins, and I'm handing over to Tom now to set the scene for the second book.
Thank you, David. So before lifting your spirits a bit after that, let me just echo a few of the thank yous, first to Matthias for hosting us and to LSE for bringing this project together, really with Kevin Young as well. LSE was a common touchstone for all of us to think about these issues. And so it's very pleasing to be back here to be able to share them with you first here. So David has given us a very stark challenge and a very stark set of issues, a very historical and, if you will, structural reason why we should all be quite depressed at the moment. So gridlock didn't exist just in our mind, in the world, but also in our thinking about how to move forward. The power of our arguments, if I may, were such that it seemed like a very difficult thing to move forward on. And so we did what people should always do when you're stuck with a very difficult problem, which is ask some people who are smarter than you what the answer should be. And so we had a great pleasure of reaching out to some really top experts in a range of global issues to help us think through these questions. We brought those people together twice, in Durham and in Oxford, with the help of the Global Challenges Foundation. And we really put them a set of difficult questions. Does gridlock apply? If so, how can we break it? And we weren't satisfied as a group with the fully satisfied, I should say, with gridlock as an explanation. Intellectually, we weren't satisfied because there were exceptions and anomalies. And as any of you who's studying the philosophy of science should know, these kind of anomalies and exceptions are important for building correct theories. You have to look at them and see where they apply to your argument, where they don't, and if not, why not. And as citizens, not just as scientists, we were concerned that this message was one of limiting our ability to make positive change in the world. So neither intellectually nor normatively were we fully satisfied with it. So we began to look for solutions. And we looked at a huge range of areas. We'll hear about some of them in a moment. But really wanted to cover the full spread of world politics, the environment, the economy, security, health, human rights, all the things that are touched by globalization, all the things that matter for people's lives at all scales and in all parts of the world. And what we found is actually, in all of these areas, two things. First, we found that gridlock does indeed largely apply in many of those places. There's really strong structural forces, historically determined forces, that are impeding progress in each of these areas. But at the same time, we found exceptions, and important exceptions, and importantly, systematic exceptions. And that became the basis of Beyond Gridlock. So what were these exceptions? What are the paths forward? Well, we wanted to think about them not as sort of silver bullets. That was clearly not going to happen, nor these kind of panaceas that we can dream up in universities, and then the world will suddenly magically move forward. Rather, the way to think about these are pathways, constellations of actors and mechanisms and processes that can help us move through gridlock, in other words, to deal with it incrementally, or potentially even move us beyond gridlock to a more transformational, more effective problem-solving set of institutions. So we had seven, and I don't want to talk to each of the seven in detail because we want to get to your thoughts and questions and examples. But just to quickly run through them, we found a lot of institutions to be autonomous, to not be affected by some of the multipolarity dynamics that we had seen to be more adaptive and able to respond to inertia in more interesting ways than we had thought previously. We found a lot of value in technical groups who were also making progress on global questions a bit below the radar of conventional politics. We found huge innovations around multiple actors taking forward global norms in different contexts, so bringing new resources, new ideas, new actors to help solve global trends, not just becoming fragmented, but being positive, additive parts of the solution. We saw a lot of positive change at the domestic level, so thinking about world politics not just at the international scale, but thinking about the bridges that connect the domestic to the international. Penultimately, we thought about a lot of interesting non-state actor coalitions, some ideas of how states can work with non-state actors to work together to affect reform. And finally, we saw a lot of innovative leadership, that gridlock is not just a condition you have to accept, but it's something you can actually think about and provide leadership in the sense of articulating new visions around and bringing people to that vision. So let me just make this slightly more concrete by grouping them into three sort of areas that we think were underappreciated in the original gridlock argument, and I would suggest underappreciated in our popular discourse today around global institutions. And we tend to think about decay, collapse, these kinds of things, and that's not necessarily the case. So first we found, you know, in the first two mechanisms, a lot of resilience. And let me just illustrate that with the example of global trade and the global trade regime, which is one of our fine, you know, motivating cases for gridlock in the first place. So yes, the World Trade Organization, the World Organization for Negotiating These Things, has not come up with a single agreement since it started trying to in 2001. And it's not unlikely to do so in the near future. It's had some plurilateral agreements, but no multilateral agreements. But if we look a bit more broadly, we see actually a huge amount of resilience there, and something called the dispute settlement mechanism, which is the, if you will, the court of the world trade regime. And this is critical. When two countries have a dispute in the 1930s, you know, as David mentioned, it would often be retaliatory tariffs and a beggar thy neighbor policies. But today people bring disputes to this body that was created in the mid-1990s. And this body has been able to somehow, through the power of law and legal reasoning, find new solutions to problems that have arisen after the sort of legislative function, if you want, the negotiating function, has stopped working. So the generative power of law, of lawmaking, of interpretation of judicial power, gives institutions a way to adapt to new situations that they can't do if they're stuck in negotiations. Similar process with technical groups in the trade world as well. The second basket of kind of pathways through and beyond focuses, I think, on innovation and adaptation. And for me, this is really actually the most exciting area because we see global governance changing form, new kinds of institutions appearing and changing the way we even think about governance in the first place. And we see this in many different areas. We'll talk about some in a second. But what I want to stress is one that's not been talked about very much in the popular discourse, but I think could be hugely important. So one of the Bretton Woods institutions created in the 40s was the International Monetary Fund, which was supposed to act as a lender of last resort. When a country has a financial crisis, they can go to the Monetary Fund to seek a bailout, essentially. And as many of the institutions created at that time were, this has become trapped a bit by the forces of gridlock. It's dominated by the United States, but other countries who have large financial reserves would like to have more of a say. They can't agree on a way to update the rules, the voting rules, to make it more fair and balanced. And the institution has lost a lot of legitimacy in places like Latin America or in sub-Saharan Africa, where it's imposed pretty stringent conditions on many countries that have sought its aid. And so in response, we've seen lots of fragmentation in the realm of financial security. Countries like Brazil or the East Asian countries coming up with their own kind of bilateral or regional agreements to kind of replace the function of the IMF. And so we had, and this is, you know, a response, in some ways a sensible adaptation to an institution that you're not fully satisfied with, but also creates this fragmentation. That's a real problem because none of these institutions is by itself able to manage global crises necessarily, or even regional ones. They're quite weak, many of them. And so the kind of firepower of lending a last resort was really in question. But more recently, this is actually a really great chapter in gridlock, if I'll say so myself, by a woman named Camila Duran from Brazil, one of the rising stars in this field. And she has found, you know, really interesting evidence of technical coordination between this welter of new regional and bilateral lending agreements and the IMF itself. So we're actually seeing a world where the big bad IMF is making deals to coordinate its bailouts with regional powers. And this is not, of course, the same thing as IMF voting reform or the same thing as recapitalizing the IMF to have the capacity to do all this, but it's a way of sharing responsibility, sharing decision-making, and bringing new resources to bear. So we're actually seeing these kind of adaptions to gridlock that can be functional. What I've laid out is, of course, an initial step. It's not any way as far as we need to go, but it lays out a model that we can follow for building a stronger infrastructure to prevent against these crises in the future. So the final basket is actually mislabeled on this slide. It's not autonomy, it's agency. Agency is the third set of ideas I would like to focus on. Because if you think about it, gridlock is really a structural argument, structural in the sense that it emerges from the properties of the system as a whole and the historical development of that system. And Professor Giddens, of course, has written a lot about this. Structure is only half the story, right? It's also about the agency, what the actors can do. And indeed, the structure and the agency are in constant tension with each other and dialogue with each other. And gridlock probably overemphasized the structural features of the argument because it was looking for systematic cross-issue explanations. But actually what we've seen in many of the exceptions is people, precisely because of gridlock, embracing new ways of exercising their agency. An example of that, which is talked about in the book, is in the response, the global response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. So if you remember the crisis, it emerged in large part because of gridlock, because the World Health Organization, the institution charged with monitoring these things, didn't do a very good job of catching the crisis early enough and responding to it forcefully enough to prevent the outbreak from spreading. And this was not entirely the fault of the World Health Organization. It was defunded by gridlock amongst competing donors in the years before. And so it was a very tangible example of the weakening of global governance leading to a crisis. And so at first, the epidemic looked like it could have huge consequences, much beyond the borders of the countries where it first emerged. But what we saw actually is quite after it reached a sort of critical threat to this country, to the United States, to powers far along, to India, to places far around the world, the global response changed into a different, much more effective agentic response. And so it was a reaction to a crisis, but an effective one, one that was not able to save the thousands of people who died in those countries, but one that was able to actually prevent the crisis from spreading globally and killing potentially many more people. So agency and how we act in the face of gridlock really does matter. So this is helpful, I think, because it shows that gridlock is something we must deal with, something we have to accept, something that exists. We can't wish it away, but we can think of how to act more or less productively given its constraints. And I'd like to just help us think about that a bit more by inviting two of our contributors to gridlock, to Beyond Gridlock, rather, to elaborate on these mechanisms in their own areas of expertise. So first, can I invite Professor Tom Pegram, who is the Deputy Director of the Center for Global Governance at UCL, University College London, and a senior lecturer there as well, to speak about Beyond Gridlock in human rights.
Great, thanks, Tom, and thanks to both of you for the invitation to join you in this really exciting project. It was really a great opportunity to, and I should say, a great challenge to really think big about the diagnostics and the responses in the grand sweep of the human rights regime, human rights governance system. And it was also, frankly, exciting and very enjoyable to engage in a truly global comparative politics conversation over those two meetings. So in my pithy 4 to 5 minutes, I think there's a slide here. Righto, there we go. So human rights, perhaps unsurprisingly, is under considerable pressure. Unsurprisingly, because the regime essentially seeks to protect the interests of those individuals at risk of abuse by the regime's own state parties. In other words, in a sense, the UN has put the fox in charge of the hen house. It is underfunded. It's often criticized as being remote from the realities of violation. And it also has few tools to directly enforce compliance. So we take pathway one then. This is really the glass empty perspective. The paralysis of the UN Security Council, particularly in the context of Syria, of course, really is emblematic of the worst symptoms of multilateral gridlock. But conversely, you also have the International Criminal Court, the emergence of what some call humanity law, which are really striking developments there that have emerged within a multilateral setting. And there's an interesting story there, which is told to some extent in the chapter. But the pathways which perhaps I drill down more on in the chapter are pathways 2 and 4, so autonomous adaptive international institutions and mobilization of domestic constituencies. So on pathway 2, what we see, curiously, is a sort of rather complex, but I would say rather interesting picture of increasingly decentralized activity, contestation advances, but of course also setbacks. So pathway 2, the acceleration in the shadow of state hierarchy of increasingly intrusive UN monitoring and verification processes, mechanisms into domestic jurisdictions, a growing emphasis, for example, on obligations of conduct in addition to obligations of outcomes, creeping into new conventions and new protocols, and also perhaps about to be incorporated into the Paris Agreement, which you'll see with the nationally determined contributions, and also ongoing efforts by national human rights institutions, other local agencies that are situated in an arrangement of dual delegation between the UN and within domestic jurisdictions, and that speaks to my own ongoing research on national human rights institutions. Of course, also crucially, as David pointed out, the bottom-up pressures are vital here. And what you see increasingly is the importance of the translation, direct action role of local activists and other intermediaries in actually ensuring that global human rights standards gain local currency. So this mediation function, if you will, between the global and local interface is absolutely vital within the human rights field in trying to, in a sense, penetrate domestic jurisdictions to try and transform state structures from within as opposed to from the top down. So what you have there is the appropriation of human rights principles by diverse local actors to better fit local contexts. Now, the biggest challenge perhaps that these agents face within the human rights setting is retaliation, especially when they seek to target core regime interests. So, for example, the extractive industry in Latin America, climate human rights activists are under unprecedented threat in the region. And of course, the killing of human rights activists poses a very grave challenge to a supposedly global protection system. But that also bears on the final point I just want to emphasize, which really speaks to the challenge that David and Tom posed to us, a very useful challenge, because by asking us to survey these pathways through or beyond a gridlock, they really put their finger on a deeper tension that animates human rights scholarship and practice, which is the question of whether the human rights project is a fundamentally transformative or reformist enterprise. And this is a very live debate currently within the human rights scholarship and, of course, within the field. So, I mean, for its detractors, human rights law matters least where it's needed most. This is their challenge. And some of those individuals, such as Stephen Hopgood, have declared the end times or the twilight of human rights. However, for others, such as Professor Philip Alston, who spoke here on Human Rights Day last year, this analysis is rejected. And really, for them, human rights has never been a consensual project. It's always been about struggle, and it remains very much about political struggle. And what I try to achieve, disciplining this domain using the gridlock pathway framework, was to lay out the contours of that debate, and ultimately concluding that the search for pathways through gridlock, even if uneven, contingent, and partial, are important, especially for the victims of human rights abuses. And that's my pithy 4 or 5 minutes. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Tom. So next I'd like to ask Professor Michael Clark to come and tell us about something very much in the news these days, nuclear security and nuclear proliferation. Professor Clark is currently at the King's College London at the Security Studies Institute, which he was a founding director of in the 90s. And more approximately, he was the director of the Royal United Services Institute, so two of the world's leading security studies institutions. So we're grateful to hear your thoughts on nuclear proliferation.
Tom, thank you very much. I approached what I was going to say today in a more narrative form, but I'm following the same outline. The fact is that nuclear weapons, by definition, weapons of mass destruction, tend towards the core interests of the major powers. It's a matter of sovereignty, core interest. It's what major powers want to do. And it's all high politics. And we used to have a famous exam question, which I've set many times down the years, where, on arms control, which is to say, when arms control is possible, it is not necessary. When it is necessary, it is not possible. Discuss. Great question. And to which there is no right answer. That's why it's a great question. But that's the sort of dilemma you have with the high politics of these things. And nuclear proliferation, WMD in general, weapons of mass destruction, but particularly nuclear proliferation, was characterized by one of the world's most effective international regimes for 30 or 40 years. You know, developing in 1963 from the Partial Test Ban Treaty, we had a series of treaties which were then driven by the SALT process, Treaty Arms Limitation Talks between Russia and America. They became the START process, ran out of steam after about 1991. They then concluded deals which they didn't ratify, and then they just let them drift. And then there was the Non-Proliferation Treaty, 1968, came into force in 1970, and that created a regime that was based on treaties, it was based on the legitimacy of the United Nations, it was based on arrangements, and it set off lots of less formal arrangements, things that were growing in formality. So things like the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, Missile Technology Control Regime, there were lots of things. You could see this thing developing with the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, as the sort of the enforcer and the reporter for what was happening. All that was pretty good until about 2001, just when the gridlock chapter was written, and it starts to go wrong. It just gets into real trouble because the core interests of the major powers had changed. And really, the 2001 is a key date, not because of 9/11, but because the Bush administration, reflecting greater skepticism that had been growing through the late 90s, moved from non-proliferation to counter-proliferation. So non-proliferation was trying to strengthen the regime. Counter-proliferation was to stop believing in the regime, really, and to say, we'll counter nuclear proliferation through our own national power. We'll do it through our own military and economic sanctions and power. And that was pretty important. In 2009, President Obama tried to go back to the regime approach. He tried to redial, to reset the whole thing. Didn't work. He made some assertive speeches. Just simply, if he'd tried it, or if it had been tried 10 or 15 years earlier, probably would have worked. 2009, it was too late. So, you know, gridlock was with us from 2003 to 2009, and the most effective regime, I think, the world has probably ever seen, was in big trouble, and it remains in trouble. So my chapter is about that, but also about two ways in which we're not going to get out of it, but we can ameliorate it, and which there may be ways forward. Two things that worry the major powers, so core interests of the major powers, link with quite a few of the seven pathways that have been mentioned in different ways. But essentially, it's the core interests of the major powers that set the climate. And the two areas are cyber and terrorism. There is increasing concern that cyber vulnerabilities are affecting nuclear deterrence. Of course, everybody worries that if you could break into the cyber of nuclear missiles, then you can do immense harm. You know, you can make them launch, you could stop them from launching, you could redirect them, you could simulate a launch, you could delay knowledge of a launch, there are all sorts of things you could do. That's, in a sense, is not the major issue. It is a major issue, it's not the major issue, because those are the crown jewels of every nuclear power, even the relatively minor ones. More important and more worrying is the secondary systems. Every nuclear power, every nuclear missile is backed up by lots of secondary systems. The fabrication processes, the components processes, the bases from which they operate, even the caterers who work on the bases from which they operate. Right? Military installations have been cyber-hacked through the street lighting that surrounds them. It's already happened. I mean, anything which is computerized, that is clear, that is near a facility, provides you with a third level to get into a second level, maybe, to get into a first level. They may be at three and four removes, but if it gets you in, it gets you in. So there's real fear about cyber vulnerabilities. And that raises new problems, as you can imagine. I talk about those in the chapter. America and China have already been talking about this, not especially effectively, given what they worry about externally, and not since the Trump administration began, but Obama and Xi Jinping had some reasonably serious talks about it. The Russians worry about it. Britain and France don't talk about it, but they worry about it. India and Israel worry about it. Pakistan claims not to worry about it, but everybody worries about Pakistan. It is widely thought, that India and particularly Pakistan are wide open to cyber hacking of their nuclear system. So that worries everybody, and that creates both top-level political will and a degree of expertise that is required. There's just not enough expertise in the world at the moment to deal with that, and I'm happy to talk about that. And then secondly, the other thing is terrorism, counter-terrorism. 2001... of course, raised the issue that, awful as 9/11 was, how much worse would it have been if elements of WMD had been present, if the planes had had chemicals on board, if radiological elements had been on board. And so the problem of loose nukes, could a nuclear device ever fall into the hands of terrorists? Very difficult to foresee that, actually. If terrorists got hold of a nuclear weapon, it almost certainly wouldn't work. I mean, nuclear weapons are far more likely not to work than to work. That's just the way they are, thankfully. So that's the James Bond scenario of a nuclear group getting hold of a terrorist group getting hold of a nuclear weapon is not really realistic. But getting hold of radiological elements, very realistic. And interestingly, far more effort is given to thinking about radiological elements than chemical. It's much easier to build a dirty chemical weapon than a dirty radiological weapon. It's not so easy to make them do real damage. I mean, the damage that a dirty bomb would do is probably relatively slight, but the psychological damage it would do could be decisive. The psychology of a dirty bomb would be a game changer. And so there is quite a lot of work, interestingly, much more on the radiological side, that's going on within the powers, between the powers, and that too involves many non-governmental, private industry specialists. And so my conclusion really is that nuclear weapons and WMD in general will always, for the foreseeable future, be a matter of high politics. It's about the core interests. But the major players, by which I mean Russia, China, United States, and then Britain and France as slightly different players, those major players are becoming increasingly worried about cyber vulnerability, about terrorism. And that worry may link into a kind of a neo-functionalist development that if you're going to do anything about cyber and terrorism, you can't only do it at the high politics level. You've got to do it in collaboration with private industry and with many other elements of civil society. It's got to be done in that way. Will it happen? I don't know. I'm not going to hold my breath. But equally, I'm not entirely pessimistic, because this is the way arms control works. It's the sort of core interests of the major players trying to maintain their hold on stability between themselves. Now, personally, I've never been a believer in nuclear deterrence, but they still believe in it, and they are beginning to be a bit more imaginative in ways to try to stabilise it, and that is a cause for some optimism. Thank you.
Great. So we're eager to get to your questions, but let us just bring it to a close by giving you one further example to make this really clear. And it's the case of climate change. Which is both a strong motivation for the original Gridlock book, as David mentioned, the failure of the Copenhagen summit, but also a significant motivation for Beyond Gridlock, because it really is an example of quite a lot of change in the world system. So when I was in fourth grade, 20-something years ago, the countries of the world promised to prevent dangerous changes in the world's climate. And they met in 1992 the first time, and the first kind of meeting that came out of that was the 1995 Berlin meeting. And they met again and 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 again. This is the Gridlock part, by the way. And again and again and again and again and again. And didn't solve very much. And I've been told, you know, the definition of insanity is to do the same thing again and again and expect a different result. And if, you know, so one of, may have questioned the sanity of some of the negotiators over these two decades. But then they met again, and something changed. And the question is why. And just to give you a little taste of that, I collected some ethnographic data from an insalubrious Parisian nightclub on the night of the signing of the agreement. This was taken there with hundreds of diplomats from all over the world. Let me see if I can get this video to work. Maybe I can't get the video to work, but what I can tell you is what they were singing, which is what the video says. So any guesses what they might have been singing? Hundreds of diplomats who had spent 20 years fighting with each other. They were singing, "We Are the Champions" by Queen. And they felt really exuberant. So the question, yeah, is why? Well, the climate change regime hasn't, we haven't solved climate change, but we've shifted our thinking about how to do it in a really interesting way. So we've gone from what you might call a top-down system, which said we should have a global deal, to a bottom-up system in which countries have to make national pledges. And they're now 190, I think 189 of them have submitted their formally their national pledges, and together they add up to something like 4 to 6 gigatons of carbon by 2030. And to put that in more concrete terms, that's the difference between a kind of 4 to 5 degree change world to maybe a 3.5 degree change world. So it's still a lot more than we want to do, which is 2 or 1.5 degree change world, but it's a huge step forward, and the biggest step forward we've ever made in those 20 years of negotiations. So it really helped to produce a breakthrough. But more importantly, they set this very ambitious goal to decarbonize the world economy by this first half of the 21st century, of this century, which is extraordinarily ambitious. And third, and most excitingly, they really welcomed in a new set of actors. So they not asked not just countries to make pledges, but businesses, cities, states, regions, investors, civil society groups, religious groups, others joined them. And if you add up all of those contributions, you get another few gigatons on top of the national pledges. So we're really bringing new resources to the issue. So how do they get there? Well, In fact, a number of the gridlock pathways were at work. So we have these good technocratic institutions creating a basis, the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, providing a scientific basis for the changes that we saw. We had changes in domestic politics, the ranked powers. China and the United States together account for about 40% of global emissions. And in the time between Copenhagen and Paris, they actually changed the way they approached the issue in a number of ways. In China, the advent of local air pollution and the extreme air pollution suffered in Chinese cities was politicized in a way it hadn't been before. And in the United States, the Obama administration realized it wasn't going to get anything from Congress and so decided to take matters into its own hands, if you will, through executive action. And so these two changes unlocked huge further changes from the rest of the world. But the third piece was equally significant. It was all these new actors getting involved, cities, businesses, other actors bringing their own contributions to the table. In other words, helping solve some of the problems themselves, but also giving national governments cover and political security that they could go even further, faster than they otherwise would. And this is the mechanism of the plurality of actors not just being fragmentation, but actually working toward common goals. And actually just yesterday we saw the city of New York say it's not just going to shoot for a 2-degree target, but actually the 1.5 degree target, the first city to do so of any major city. So finally we saw what I think is really the kind of key beyond gridlock point, though, which is the idea that leaders were able to articulate a new vision for climate change. So after those 20 years of failed negotiations, people could have easily, and most likely, would have just done the same thing yet again and again and again and again. But actually, policy actors showed agency. Leaders like Cristian Figueres, who I will note has a blurb on the back of the book, really were able to help communicate a new idea of doing things and bring people to that vision. And that kind of agency, that kind of leadership, is what we'll need, I think, to solve other kinds of gridlock going forward. So I'm going to turn it over to David to bring things to a close before we get to our questions. But I think just thinking across the three examples we've shown you, very different issue areas, human rights, nuclear security, climate change, a common set of blockages, but also some common pathways forward. Not silver bullets, but helpful steps. And that's, I think, some cause for optimism in this time.
So you can read the key message. I don't have to repeat it. But what drives this, in conclusion, what drives this book is the view that, you know, if you think of previous centuries of thinking about how change happens, you know, for many in the 16th, 17th century, is ultimately, you know, the god behind the machine that makes things happen. Then it's the state that is the black box to which we can, onto which we can project change. In the 19th century, for Karl Marx and others, it was the proletariat. And when the proletariat didn't do the job, it was the political party. And when the political party didn't do the job, it was other things. But actually, what this serious book tells us is that there's no guarantee of change at the global level, but there are many useful pathways. And if you understand how those pathways work, and you understand how they work across different sectors, it empowers you as agents and actors to think about the constellation of institutions and changes you need in different sectors, not to create silver bullets of change, but useful ways forward. So what is Beyond Gridlock in the end? Beyond Gridlock does something that no one else has done before. And in that sense, it's just a step forward, I think. It creates a comparative framework for the analysis of change at the global level. It creates a theoretical framework of these pathways, which you then can test across these 12 different sectors. And in the end, we bring it together, not in the dark way I talked about, but in a qualified optimism that despite Trump and Brexit and all these things across the world, if you drill down and look at what is going on beneath the surface, there are many reasons to be cautiously optimistic. And climate, to come back to that in the last one, is a very powerful image, because Trump turns away from the Paris Agreement, but within 3 weeks, civil society of the United States, led by cities, states, universities, and companies, stands up and says, despite what the United States as a government will deliver, and if it won't deliver it, we will honor the agreement of the Paris Agreement. That shows a remarkable set of shifts in how politics works, how power is aligned, how constellations of interest function. So what we hope we've done in Beyond Gridlock is we can't promise a revolution or silver bullets or social movements that can unlock all this. But it's complicated and difficult. But if you look at these sectors and compare them, you can throw up these very interesting, distinct pathways of change that apply to different sectors in different ways and actually show all the good work that is done now and can be done in the future to make a difference to these many, many pressing problems. And that's a good message in these otherwise troubling times, I think. So in the end, although it's not a silver bullet, it's a positive set of narratives driven by a set of clear analytical concerns. Thank you for listening.
So we can take questions now. Please raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Wait for the steward to identify you, so I will point towards you. And before asking the question, please introduce yourself briefly.
Thank you. Ewan Grant, I'm a former law enforcement intelligence analyst, so much of my work has been spent looking for clues and what they mean and how you join them up. How are members of the major international bodies reacting to your book and the issues you raise? Do you see any indications of they're galvanizing, or even if they're not, that they're aware? Or do you see institutional inertia as you described? Thank you.
I can take a stab at that one. So I would be honored if many of the leaders of international organizations had time to digest it fully yet, but I think probably it's still, you know, in their inbox, must be. look, I think the way these ideas have impact is not by convincing politicians that they can they can stand up for something they're not don't have a political incentive to stand up for. Rather, it's helping a whole range of actors develop more effective strategies for making progress in global change. And that means, yes, national governments, but also each of us in the room, thinking of how our votes and our contributions to these kinds of debates are happening. It's how the media should frame the issue, to think about it as a kind of great power rivalry or in a different way. It's how civil society groups should target their campaigns. It's how foundations should allocate their funding. It's really a range of ideas. And as David said, our hope is to articulate pathways of change, not to give sort of specific, you know, policy programs to governments. I will just, though, say that, as I said before, Christiana Figueres said it was great, so I think it's inherited a little bit.
I just will add one other thing to that, which is that, of course, I mean, all academics, when they produce a book that is policy relevant and they think is, you know, represents some kind of shift in thinking, hope it is influential, but in a sense, this book has actually learned from the innovations going on around us. So whilst, of course, it would be desirable if a large number of these international organizations and so on put this on their agenda, read it, discussed it at board meetings, the really important thing about gridlock, beyond gridlock, is it's systematizing the patterns of change we can detect and see already. So what we're doing is giving a theoretical articulation to that. And the climate example is probably the best one of all. The breakdown of top-down negotiations over 20 years, then a few years of stumbling around trying just to aggregate bottom-up promises. But then with Paris, you get this very significant imaginative breakthrough, which is not just about aggregating what states offer, but builds in a ratchet and review mechanism every 5 years. And that linked to these huge global shifts in power and interest that underpins it, that underpins the phenomenal moment when Trump says no, but America says yes. That is what we're trying to articulate in these different areas. So we want people to read it, and we want people to see what it looks like when systematized. But the good news is a lot of this is going on beneath the surface anyway. And hence, there are breakthroughs. There are ways of getting out of the negative cycle of gridlock, populist backlash, gridlock, and so on.
Yes, two questions here, please.
So I think one of the interesting things about your work is that you're looking at from the field of political science and you're taking it over to a new field. So it takes the analysis from a macro institutional perspective, and it hands it over almost to the sociologists, or the people who are studying the NGOs and the grassroots, to say, right, so the answer is now with you at a micro level, and how do you anticipate this kind of field? How do you anticipate academia adapting to this?
And this lady behind, yes?
I was interested that you were talking about the Bretton Woods institutions and sort of the 70 years of history as quite positive and virtuous. And I was wondering if actually the trends you're seeing now might actually be more virtuous and actually truly global and be more resilient in terms of leading to those outcomes that you're sort of talking about in terms of global challenges.
Great. Sure. Let me first address the question on how should academia think about this. And I think, you know, we often approach these questions with very established cognitive categories. So we have institutional inertia, but we also have cognitive inertia and how we think about global problems. And climate change is a great example of this, right? We often thought, here is a global problem. It's a quintessential global problem, right? Because emissions anywhere affect the climate everywhere. And so we need some kind of global deal to constrain emissions from everyone, or we can't solve the problem. And that idea is very prevalent today, even so. But the Paris Agreement actually moves away from that in a very interesting way, right? It says, we're not going to try to get a global deal for everyone that will force everyone to do something. We're going to try to change their preferences over time by setting an aspirational target, a round of pledges from review, and bringing in new voices. And I don't think academia has caught up with that yet, frankly. I mean, some of us are trying to write about it, but it's I'm not sure what the LSE syllabus looks like at the moment in the Intro to International Relations course, but I guarantee it at Oxford it has, you know, global collective action is all through global institutions in week one. So I think these implications are new, and the pace of change is rapid, and therefore intellectual thinking about them is catching up. And I think it really is a rate problem, you know, a problem of change over time, not a sort of figuring this out and then we'll have it solved, right? This is going to change again and again and again. And this acceleration is something that our institutions of any kind are not very well geared to, academia included.
Well, there are two different questions here. One is about, you know, how does the academic community respond? Well, an academic community increasingly geared to REF, the TEF, and all these other mechanisms of accountability is likely to continue to respond on its current pathway. So in a sense, it is for Tom and I, really, and hopefully the others who are part of this project, to try and push this now as hard as we can. So I don't think there are any guarantees in a positive academic uptake. I think we have to try and create one. The second thing is, of course, you're right about 70 years. First of all, I gave a sort of very abstract generalization. The book itself drills down to, of course, much more complex pictures. And indeed, even if you just think about the 70 years, it's the function of the Cold War, the nuclear terror that partly underpins that period of relative global stability. But at the same time, of course, there were proxy wars fought out in the global south of all number of kinds and so on. So the picture is more complicated than the one I could offer in 15 minutes. And there are upsides about the current period. And if you go to many developing countries and talk about this project, they say it's good that gridlock is happening because it freezes these institutions that were never representative of our voices and creates a new political opportunity to create south-south linkages, new kinds of institutions across the board. That's a positive story, you're right. The question is, though, of course, can you scale up these institutions sufficiently to deal with these big global challenges? And that's where I think some skepticism comes in. Certainly, I think increasing South-South connections and institutional structures will fit into leadership and the positive leadership response to gridlock. It fits into the seventh pathway very well. And many of these South-South political leaders are very conscious that this whole 70-year trajectory of institution building has stopped, and let's take advantage of that. So I think it could yield positive results. We just don't know. I'm a great fan of Hegel's famous statement in the philosophy of right, the owl of Minerva spreads its wings for the coming of dusk. We don't know yet, only by looking back. But it's a possibility.
Yes, Professor Giddens here.
Well, I could lob David. Tony Giddens, the aforesaid former director of the LSE. I'll lob David a couple of easy questions.
Tony has always been my biggest critic.
Well, as you know, I spent the last few years working on the digital revolution, which seems to me going at a pace and a global scope that no one has ever seen before in human history. And my question is, where is it in all this? So I was very pleased to hear Professor Clark discuss cybersecurity so accurately, but I've been to quite a few, you know, discussions of international relations. It doesn't really figure. People haven't really somehow worked it in. To me, it's absolutely central. Globalization in that sense is not going into reverse. It's completely the opposite. There has never been a world globalized like this. Never. Instantaneous communication across the world. Deeply involved with the rise of populism. Deeply involved with many of the trends which are threatening to empty out democratic systems, because movements are replacing parties to some degree. It's not here. To me, it should be here. And it would have to be worked into this kind of analysis, I feel. And while there are so many things that one could say about it, but this is something new, and it more or less converges with the period you're discussing. You're talking about the period from like the 1980s or so through to the current times, the period when this just vast, sort of overwhelming set of changes are occurring that we're all still trying to diagnose. Well, the second question is really, what do you make of the literature on progress and books like Norberg on progress or Pinker on violence? I mean, to me, they're interesting. And, you know, Pinker's analysis, for example, is much disputed. Nevertheless, it's quite powerful in its way. It has a pretty strong statistical backing to it. And Norberg's book also in its way, even though, I hate to say, an academic written by a journalist called Progress, it's also really impressive when you look at it on a global scale. It looks very different from the current. You know, everyone discovered populism after the event. No one I know really predicted its rise. Everyone thinks they did afterwards, just like everyone thinks they've got an explanation of the financial crisis, which nobody predicted. Everyone rushes in the day after as though they always knew about it. I think they're worth taking account of, that kind of book, because there just has been enormous progress across the world in a way, again, which has not been seen before in human history. And much of that is still going on. There's never been a transformation like that happening in China, from poverty and starvation, mass killing, to prosperity within 30 years. China's even gone from starvation to an epidemic of obesity in 30 years, 20% obesity in the major Chinese cities. So, interesting to hear your brief concluding comments on that, and congratulations on the work. And as one of the founders of Polity Press, we're very pleased with what's been achieved. I think it's done very well for Polity as well.
There's two things to say initially in response to that. That I said at the beginning, Tony has always been my mentor, so I expect him to be asking questions which are ahead of my humble thinking. Secondly, you know, with friends like Tony, who needs enemies, as it were, I mean, these are. But that's always been the case, and we've got over it. But these are very important sets of issues. I'll deal with them in reverse. On progress, indeed, I mean, the argument that we started with, but, you know, that needs to, that the book Gridlock fleshes out, is there's been enormous progress. I mean, in all my work on globalization in the 90s and so on, you know, you can see the way in which globalization has brought extraordinary opportunities and change across the world. 85% of luxury goods are now sold in China. It's an absolutely astonishing statistic, accompanied by the fact that 400 million people have been lifted out of poverty in 30 years. These are huge and powerful trends. The progress literature picks up a lot of that and systematizes it, and that's very good. In the chapter on global health, which I wrote in this book with a colleague, Garrett Brown, we can easily track much of the progress on global health in many, many areas. But the progress is finely balanced. There's great fragility. And the truth is, we don't know, and that's why the Hegel quote is so powerful, we don't know sitting here whether this progress will continue to be built on or whether some of these global challenges that we are describing here will overrun us. We just don't know at this time.
To me, like a high risk, high opportunity.
Exactly. And exactly. No, exactly. Globalization creates enormous opportunities.
The risk and the opportunities.
Tony always interrupted me, and nothing has changed here either. So, indeed, it creates enormous opportunities, but high risks, because our capacity to manage these risks, formerly based in states, now requires something new and innovative and different. So I think that the progress literature faces its opposite, which is a very dark literature that your friend Martin Rees and so on has written about at length. When Martin, the former chief astronomer and president of the Royal Society, argues that it's highly unlikely humankind will reach the end of the 21st century without a major setback. He did, that's a quote. And I saw him recently, and he said since then he is more pessimistic. The point being that we do not know how this scenario of progress and calamity will play out in the 21st century. But the good news is these pathways help us understand how to consolidate the good work that has been done, and that's exactly why we've done this work. On the digital revolution, well, of course, the digital revolution has underpinned globalization in the last four decades or so. It is the mediating variable. And we don't know, as you quite rightly say, where it will take us. And perhaps one of the reasons why these large old institutions are breaking down is because the new information world order allows people to circumvent it and change. That is a positive. But when you're faced with global challenges, some of which are existential, bottom-up change alone is insufficient. And we see that, for example, in the Arab Spring. Everybody worshipped the Arab Spring as a sign of a new hip generation Facebook groups that could link together and make change happen from bottom up. 4 or 5 years later, that now looks over-optimistic because the old structures were still capable of suppressing change in many of those countries. We'll discuss that more later.
Well, just another example that is in the book is the Occupy Wall Street as an example of a social movement that also had great ambitions, had huge spread, but didn't actually lead to many policy changes, didn't actually have an effect on the problem it was seeking to solve. And we contrast that in the book with the sort of civil society movements of the 1990s, things like the landmine ban campaign, the campaign that led to the creation of the International Criminal Court, the Beijing Women's Conference. There you had coalitions of civil society groups and progressive state actors working together and sort of with an inside-outside strategy to create real policy changes that we can all see and touch today. The newer digital movements haven't yet done that. Maybe they will. We talk about this in the book as a kind of potential pathway of change. Several of the chapters go into it. But it hasn't yet been done. And this is not to say it can't be done, but I think as the recent elections have shown, these tools can go in many ways, and what's needed is really, I think, the social technology to figure out how to use them more for progressive pathways of change, which we haven't figured out yet. But looking forward to continuing the discussion. Should we?
Would you like to add something?
Oh,